Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. I'm lucky to serve on the Tulsa World's Community Advisory Board. This activity involves writing at least two op-ed pieces for the paper each year for 2 years, and attending an annual luncheon at which we discuss what we think are the biggest issues, and indeed likely to be news stories, for the Tulsa region in the coming year. As you might imagine, the board is comprised of nearly two dozen people from all aspects of the community, businesses, faith leaders, education, nonprofits, and arts, to name a few. At this year's meeting, I was part of a small group that discussed Oklahoma's future based on our current political climate, both at the state level and nationally. One of the people in my group was Susan Harris, who retired from the Tulsa Regional Chamber in 2013 after a 22-year career there, rising to the rank of Senior Vice President for Education and Workforce Development. While at the Chamber, Harris also led their health policy group, and she was part of the effort that led to Tulsa being open enough to study its life expectancy gap back in 2004 and 5, the so-called Lewin Report. It turns out that Susan Harris is also a caregiver. After raising her own children, she's had at least one elderly family member in different assisted living or nursing home environments around Tulsa for the past 20 years. Her experiences have given her tremendous insight, and she's developed some rules of the road for families who might be faced with permanent placement of a loved one in an extended care environment. Susan Harris, retired Tulsa Chamber Senior Vice President for Education, Workforce, and Healthcare, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Susan Harris, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by just talking about caregiving. You have been a longtime caregiver for senior members of your family, and you had some really interesting observations about it to share with our listeners, and thank you very much for being willing to come on the air and talk about it.
Yeah.
So, when did this start?
Started in 1997. My aunt and my grandmother, who lived together in Dallas, moved up here, and we were looking for a place for the two of them to be in the same facility. My grandmother needed a nursing home, and my aunt needed independent living at that point. But we wanted them to be near each other because my aunt couldn't drive. She'd lost her eyesight to macular degeneration. So we moved them up here to a facility that could accommodate both of them. And then about 6 years later, my parents moved here from Alabama when my dad's health failed, and my mother was already blind with macular degeneration.
Wow.
So they moved into a different independent living facility. And then later, my mother-in-law moved here, moved into the same facility where the others lived. And then, of course, we've been in nursing homes for skilled nursing and rehab, and then assisted living with two of them, you know, the longest lived of the two. And both of them, you know, are finishing their lives in nursing homes. Now, I've got one left,
wow.
My aunt.
So this has been continual since then.
I mean,
that's almost 20 full years of being a caregiver.
Yes.
And you have a lot of healthcare knowledge because you worked at the Chamber for a number of years involved in health policy, healthcare.
Right.
So I guess what were some of the challenges? I mean, beside the obvious, you know, frailties of getting older, what were some of the challenges of the healthcare system as people went from, say, they had an illness or a surgery, went to hospital, and then back to some kind of skilled nursing or something? I mean, you had some, unfortunately, some bad stories too.
Yes, we've had some, there are some places in town I would never go to again, and some that might surprise people, but we've also had some good experiences. But I think one of the things I learned that I wish I'd known sooner is that when a hospital says that your senior citizen is going to be discharged and you've got, you know, this is the evening and they're going to discharge them the next day, and oh, by the way, you need to choose a place for skilled nursing or physical therapy. They're going to be there for 2 to 3 weeks, whatever your insurance will allow. And here's your list, that you don't have to do it the way the hospital says you're doing it. You can actually protest and say, I want another day to go check these out. It's 6 o'clock at night. I can't check my sources and I don't have time to go visit, and I need tomorrow to go visit, and we will do the discharge the day after. I didn't know you could do that, but you can.
And that's under presumably Medicare or really
any
kind
of Medicare. Yes, Medicare. Yeah, all of my family have been under Medicare, so.
Okay, and so you have that extra day in there if you need it.
You can protest that discharge. And the hospitals, you know, the social worker comes to you and they give you a list, or they'll say, where would you like to send them? Once they figure out you've been a few places, and then they'll check and see if there's space. And that's always the challenge, because the place you want may not have space.
And a lot of them run near capacity, right? I mean,
they're sure trying to. I mean, you know, this skilled nursing rehab, is the reimbursement rate is much higher than for long-term care. So they want to keep those beds full.
And we're probably worth pointing out that skilled nursing, and acute rehab is covered by Medicare, whereas long-term care usually isn't.
Long-term care is not covered at all. But the skilled and the physical therapy, say if somebody had fallen at home and they went to the hospital for 3 days to be checked out because they had a possible head problems or did you break your hip or whatever, and then they keep them. You have to stay in the hospital for three midnights to be entitled to get skilled nursing under Medicare. So everybody knows how to work that because they know these folks need some additional care, but they don't need the intensive care you get in a hospital. But they need that therapy and, you know, the kinds of things you can get in skilled nursing. So there are a lot of things you have to look for when you make that decision. I mean, what kind of place is it? Who are the caregivers? You know, you need to check out the food because for every old person I've taken care of, that's the most important thing. And the environment, you know, I'll never forget at one place, my dad and I got there on Halloween night and it took 4 hours for the nurse at the facility to check him in. I had to leave him alone on the bed and go to a fast food place to get him some dinner because when the ambulance from the hospital got us there, it was past dinner time and no one would go find him food. That's the only place that's ever happened to us. And it was awful. They didn't check him in until 11 o'clock at night. And then that Sunday night, he and I are sitting there as waiting for dinner. And my dad, the engineer, who really didn't care what things looked like, looked around and said, "This is pretty bleak, isn't it?" And I thought, oh, my God, if my dad knows this, this is bad. And it was. It was very bad. The dining room was dreary. We never saw anybody at the facility smile. And that was our first experience. That's when I learned you don't take the suggestions of the social worker without going to check. The social worker's trying to find a bed. It's not her relative.
Right. You know. Now, you, I think, also told me that, I don't know if it was with your father, but with one of your loved ones, that you had were so disappointed by a facility, and I don't remember which type that
it was. It was my aunt, yeah.
Yeah, that you wanted to essentially switch facilities, but what barriers there were to doing that?
Well, actually, the switching facilities with my grandmother, I didn't feel that the nursing home we had her in was providing consistent, high-quality care. She had diverticulosis, and she could not have corn, nuts, strawberries, or anything with seeds. But otherwise, she was going to have intestinal bleeding. And there was a sign in her room. She was blind, so she couldn't see what they brought her until she put it in her mouth. And there were notes in the kitchen, but the people in the kitchen didn't read English.
This was
in 1997. And so my grandmother, who refused to go to the dining room, and had a tray in her room, would wait until someone would say to her, you know, you've got green beans at 2 o'clock, you've got meatloaf at 6 o'clock, and there are potatoes up at 10 o'clock. And because she was afraid there'd be corn on there, and she wasn't going to eat it. And sometimes there was corn.
Oh.
Yeah, you know. And then she got pneumonia, and when I got there one day, and I knew she had pneumonia, but they'd had a shift change, and the new nurse didn't even know. I thought, ooh, this is not good. This is not good.
And so you decided to move.
Well, we thought about it, but instead we just doubled down on paying attention and causing trouble, making sure that, you know, everybody knew, leaving lots of notes, calling at odd times, making sure they didn't know when we were coming by, just to kind of keep up the pressure to provide good care.
Is that a strategy you read and learned about anywhere or just totally developed on your own?
Developed.
Wow. Mm-hmm. These are good advice points.
Well, I mean, you know, what I've learned is if you have somebody in a long-term care facility or assisted living for that matter, you need to be there as often as possible, even if it's not for a long period, but as often as possible. You should go at different times of the day so you can meet different sets of staff and get to know the staff so that you know who you can go to. And if you spot a trouble, call the person who can make a difference. So I always had the executive director's phone number just in case.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Susan Harris, who for 22 years plus was Senior Vice President for Education and Workforce at the Tulsa Regional Chamber and also is on the Tulsa World's Community Advisory Board, where we were engaged in a discussion about important stories in the Tulsa community. And I of course, think caregiving and aging as our population ages and over 10,000 baby boomers are turning 65 every day is perhaps the story of this generation, but we're so inured to it, we often take it for granted and don't think about it. And so Susan has been the active caregiver for at least 5 different family members ongoing for 20 straight years in Tulsa. One of the things that you mentioned to me was about the importance of CNAs. These are certified nursing assistants.
Right.
And how the lion's share of work seems to fall to them. And of course, if you do it on a sort of a job ladder or pyramid, they often are at the bottom. And what are some of the struggles they face?
Well, CNAs are the frontline caregivers, so they do all the heavy lifting. They're the ones that are taking, you know, my family members to the bathroom and cleaning them up and giving them baths and making sure they're comfortable and bringing them blankets and keeping an eye out for them falling, all that kind of thing. And they're not paid high wages. And so most of the CNAs that I've come in contact with are working as many as 60 to 80 hours a week. They pick up extra shifts. Some of them have jobs at 2 different facilities. That happened to one CNA I remember when my dad was in long-term care. And she, you know, worked where daddy was during the week. And then on the weekends, she worked at another facility and she would pick up extra shifts. And a lot of times they're raising children on this. And that's really hard. You know, and if they're good at what they're doing, it's discouraging because they really make all the difference. At the assisted living that both my dad and my aunt lived in, that we dearly loved, the reason that they, I think, are so successful is because many of their CNAs have been there 10 to 15 or even more years. And so they know the residents. They know everybody's health history. They know everybody's interests. They know what they like and don't like. They know how, if, you know, for instance, my dad was a very cheerful man, and I got a call one time from one of the CNAs, and she said, "We think you need to get up here. Your dad was really cranky this morning. I think he's sick." Sure enough, he had a urine infection. I mean, they picked up on it really fast. You know, that's when you know you've got good staff, and it's hard. And it doesn't take a lot of training to be a CNA, and they don't make much money, but you sure need good ones.
Often, as you point out, they work many, many hours and have caregiving burdens of their own in terms of family.
Yeah.
So wouldn't it be ideal in a sense if we could develop educational programs in which they could progress? And I mean, we have a nursing shortage as well.
We sure do. I know that from working at the chamber that nurses are in high demand. And of course, a lot of the long-term care, the nurses are licensed practical nurses, LPNs, which at Tulsa Tech takes about 18 months if you do it diligently. It can take longer if you spread it out, I think. But, you know, it'd be ideal if CNAs started as CNAs and then got their LPN. And then, of course, there's an LPN to RN conversion that you can do through Tulsa Community College. And then you can take your RN, go to OU, or some of the other nursing schools, but OU's the one in town, and get your BSN.
Right.
And obviously, once you get to your RN and BSN, you can make a really good wage and you're in demand. Everybody in town will hire you.
Is it just a supply and demand issue in terms of, when I think of my profession in the medical school world, I mean, there's this whole weed out process in terms of grades and scores and doing the pre-medical requisites, and then there's a very sort of tight control over the number of seats in medical schools, but that's not necessarily the case at all for nursing. I mean, there's, as we've talked about, there's this shortage, so it would seem like you have a lot of CNAs who might be very interested in career mobility and sort of moving up the ladder, and yet there just seem to be barriers to entry to that.
My guess is a lot of it's financial, and there may be some academic barriers that some of the CNAs just don't feel like they are properly prepared to enter into an LPN or RN program. Now, I've known LPNs at my dad's nursing home who were getting their RNs. Of course, once they got their RNs, they moved on.
Wanted to work in the hospital or wherever where they could earn more, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think it is about that one place that you mentioned where the CNAs had been there for a decade or more? I mean, were you ever able to figure out what it was that gave it such a human element and a connection?
Yeah,
it's
Aberdeen Heights at 72nd and Yale, and they have a very stable executive. Anita, who is the executive director there, has been there for like 20 years.
Uh-huh.
And I think she creates an environment where the CNAs feel valued and part of the team. And she works very hard to keep them and to hire the right people who will stay. You know, I've seen other CNAs at other facilities that they come and just as a patient's family member, you can kind of think, oh, I don't know if they've got what it takes. And sure enough, in 6 weeks, they're gone.
Huh.
You know.
Yeah, well, that's certainly
so. Some of it's the hiring and the screening process. You know, Aberdeen Heights seems to really have it down for finding good people and then keeping them happy.
One of the things that came up also in your former life, in your former career, was that you—I didn't know this—but had a key role in bringing this, what we call the Lewin study, to Tulsa. That Dr. Jerry Clancy, who's now the president of TU and was very involved with the chamber and eventually became mm-hmm. chamber chair, pushed hard to bring, I guess, an outside consulting group in to do the study that showed that there was this life expectancy disparity
right.
between people in North Tulsa and the rest of Tulsa, about 14 years.
Yeah, in certain zip codes in North Tulsa compared to the wealthiest zip codes in South Tulsa, it's 14 years life expectancy difference, which is just outrageous. And it's all about access to health care.
It's also about, you know, other things, economic opportunity and educational
economic opportunity. Inequities. I mean, all of it ties together, inequities in opportunities, in education, in income, and then access to health care. And obviously, because of this study, so many things have been put into place. OU put in some more clinics in North Tulsa. I think OSU has also done that. The health department has done their part. We've got a new federally qualified health center that we didn't have at the time of the Lewin study. And so there are people have really taken very deliberate and thoughtful steps to increase access to health care, to primary health care, but then also then for the specialists, which a lot of times people who are on Medicaid or some kind of government plan may not have easy access to the next level of care.
Right, and certainly also for uninsured. Now, mm-hmm. one other thing that I learned from you that was really interesting that I was not aware of was that you said as far back as 1985, was it the chamber that got a grant from Robert Wood Johnson to
yes.
study the problem of the uninsured?
$1.5 million grant, because the business leaders in town knew that we had compared to other communities and other states, we had an unusually high number of uninsured. And the problem when you have uninsured, and certainly back in the 80s and 90s, the people who are insured are paying for that care, because people who are uninsured get their care at the most expensive point in the system, which is the emergency room. That's not a good place to get primary care. But if you're not insured, you don't have any choice. So when you get really sick, you go to the emergency room. Well, that drives up a hospital's costs. Hospitals spread their costs. That's why aspirins cost so much.
Right.
When we all know that, you know, back when you used to see all those bills. And so the large employers in town knew that because of cost shifting, they were paying the cost for those uninsured. So if we could figure out a way to get all those uninsured into the healthcare system at a not just less costly point, but also a more effective point in terms of healthcare, the whole community would be better off. Not only could we moderate the rate of increase in healthcare inflation and costs in this community, but we would also have a population of people who were healthier and could possibly get better jobs that would allow them to support their families.
I wonder if, you know, in that time, 30 plus years since the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation came in and did that study on uninsured, lots has changed.
A lot has changed.
But a lot yeah. maybe has. I mean, do you feel like we've made real progress on the number of uninsured? I mean, we certainly have the Affordable Care Act, but Oklahoma is one of the minority of remaining states that yeah. has not expanded Medicaid. So we still yeah. have, relatively speaking, a high proportion of uninsured.
Right. Yeah. I think the Affordable Care Act, while it wasn't perfect, was a major step forward. And I certainly wish Oklahoma had taken advantage and expanded Medicaid, because I think as a state, it's a huge loss. Anytime you have people who can't get good health care, you are wasting human potential, and that's a shame. And it affects not just the person who's ill, but the rest of their family, whether it's a child and you've got the adults who have to care for that child, or whether it's adults who then can't reach their full potential and participate in the community, have a job, be good parents, et cetera. I mean, it affects everybody. So I'm very sad that the Affordable Care Act, that we seem to be in retreat on that. But there are a lot of other things have changed too. I mean, we're seeing healthcare systems look at the full continuum of care. And there are a lot of fancy names for that. But I think managing people's care better is really helpful.
So team-based care or
team-based
chronic disease
care,
management.
Chronic disease and targeting those folks who do have chronic disease, people with diabetes or heart disease, and managing it better. Just some things that clinics do as a routine now that wasn't true 25 years ago. You get all these reminders to not forget your appointments.
Right.
You know, when I first got into this policy stuff in the 90s, that was one of the issues that Medicaid patients, people would say, you know, it was a stereotype, well, they'll miss their appointments. They won't come, so doctors don't want to treat them. Well, now doctors' offices and clinics and hospitals, you know, they text you reminders, they call you, they have these robocalling systems. So, you know, everybody recognizes that you've got to make sure that people are complying with their program of care.
Well, in the world we live in, if people don't show up for the visit, there's no bill generated.
That's
so it's,
true.
It's important
to
the bottom line.
Yes.
So it's the win-win in terms of the bottom line, but also for the healthcare delivery. Something else I learned about you was in your role at the chamber. Prior to your work at the chamber, you were involved politically in running campaigns and things. But so during your time at the chamber, you were very involved in bond campaigns, public funding campaigns.
Yes.
And this is something that the chamber does to try to, you know, help the city and the county and the region achieve progress in terms of capital infrastructure. I mean, what were some of the things you were involved in? It sounded like when you listed them, a huge number of different things. What are the key elements to? First of all, I guess dumb question, but you know, why do we pass bond packages?
Well, we pass bond packages because in Oklahoma, that's the way you fund infrastructure, or in the case of schools, capital improvements. And it's the only way you could do that because the stream of operating money is just not sufficient to invest in infrastructure. And anybody who's driven on Tulsa roads knows we need to invest in our infrastructure. So that's how you do it.
So there were, you said school bond packages, but also what other ones were you involved with?
Oh, TPS bond packages, both vision campaigns, the river campaign, which we lost, the city sales tax, third penny extension, the city bond packages when you actually vote bonds for streets and sewer and other infrastructure, Fortifix the county.
So, I guess what were some of the lessons you gleaned from that? I mean, organization's got to be obviously very important.
Well, organization and the planning leading up to the bond. When TPS, for instance, started asking the community to invest in the buildings, we lost a bond in 94 and 95. Then we won in 96, and we haven't lost since. So a lot of things that we've learned over the time. One, you've got to have really good planning, and it needs to involve the community, or in the case of the city council, the whole council, because you've got to look at the needs of all parts of the city and make sure it's not, I mean, I don't, I would never disparage staff at either the schools or the city, but, you know, if you just look at their list, sometimes you miss some things that the citizens think are important, and those have to be part of the package. So the planning leading up to the package, the bond or the sales tax, whatever it's going to be, is very important. Then there has to be a really thorough feedback to the community about what you did. So in the case of the city in the early days, it was a bond oversight. Now the city council does that because they represent each district. At Tulsa Public Schools, they have a bond oversight committee that meets monthly and reports back to the board and says this is where we're going and keeps an eye on things. And those are very important. But I think then when you're doing the campaign, it's really important to educate the community about what's in the package and why it's important to them, whether they're of various ages or they live in different parts of the city. It was when we did the first vision campaign to build the BOK Center, there were an awful lot of people who said, we don't need that, nobody will come, we won't get the concerts, nobody's going to pay those ticket prices, and guess what?
We're
one of the most successful event center in the country, and we rank high in world listings too. So things like that do work, and it took a lot of education to get people to understand that this was important and that this was going to lead to more development downtown.
So one of the biggest issues before us right now is, and it's not new, but school funding and the issue of teacher pay, but it's also the constrained ability of a locality, in this case Tulsa or the suburbs, based on the school funding formula. And Mayor Bynum has made this kind of a key piece of his agenda is to try to campaign with the state. so that if we were to raise, say, a school levy to raise a property tax to go earmark to our schools, our teachers, and school infrastructure, public education, that we don't lose the state appropriation through the
right.
funding formula. Was that something, you know, you were there for 20 years. Is that something that was sort of always looked at and talked about or just thought to be impossible based on past state legislative action?
Well, we've always talked about ways to increase funding. Having the city partner with us is new. The chamber at various times on the legislative agenda had asked the state to do a constitutional amendment that would allow a local school district to then pass additional millage, say, for excellence, that would not be chargeable to the base formula, which means lose the state money. Because you don't want to, you know, why should we raise $5 million in Tulsa and lose $5 million out of the other pocket from the state? You don't want to do that. And that's what would happen now. So we've talked about it over the years, but it's really nice to have the city reach out and say to the various school districts, we want to be part of this.
Yeah, so that is new. I mean,
yes,
in fact,
it is.
Are you confident that if you had to forecast or look in your crystal ball, do you think that we can sort of move the needle on that?
I would sure hope so, but I'm very discouraged with the way the legislature's been behaving. If they couldn't get the majority they needed to pass the tax or the revenue measures that they had on the table for this special session, I'm not sure we can get them to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, although we don't need a three-fourths of the legislature to vote for it.
Right.
We only need 50% plus one. So.
One other interesting thing you shared with me offline was that you used to be, was it head or chair of the League of Women Voters for, was it Tulsa
yeah.
County?
it was Metropolitan Tulsa, 1979 to 81. It's a long time ago. You probably weren't even born then.
Oh no, I was born. I was in school. Have the issues? I mean, I assume is the League of Women Voters still very active and still
yes.
exist? Are you still involved?
Not very much.
No.
No.
Okay, but so they come up with an agenda and
yes,
items.
Okay. Yeah. The league looks at issues and they have strong positions on a number of things.
What were some of the key issues back in the day when you were chairing?
Well. One of them was the lack of women at the top of Tulsa Public Schools. We got very active in that. Another one was the then proposed third penny sales tax for infrastructure. The first time out, the voters did not approve it. Second time out, the league endorsed it, and the Tulsa Junior League and the League of Women Voters partnered to do a volunteer phone bank. And we were credited by then Mayor Inhofe, who's now Senator Inhofe, with being the key to passing the third penny. So that was, you know, exciting. We were very effective on that.
Wow.
And we were very effective with TPS because obviously they have women at the executive levels.
They sure do.
A superintendent, plus others, plus at the principalships of the middle schools and the high schools, in the 70s they did not.
Did not. No. Well, Susan Harris, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for sharing your personal story with us,
sure.
Many of your personal stories, but also just some of your wisdom about the community at large. It's been really great talking to you.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.